being able to shoot good quality photos that are nice and sharp is pretty much a fundamental requirement, I think, for most photographers. You know, you want to really be producing photographs where you have a nice, sharp result. But before I get into six things you can do if that isn't quite happening for you, or I can tell you where it might be going wrong if you're finding that, the first thing I want you to think about is just planning the photograph. So I'm a big believer in kind of pre-thinking what I'm going to shoot, so that I've got some idea of what I need to think about for all sorts of aspects of the photograph. And if you think about it, having something that is absolutely pin sharp in the image, it's a little bit like a headline. This is an analogy I read recently. And what's the purpose of the headline? Well, the thing is, if you are looking at a headline in a book or an article or whatever it might be, the purpose of the headline is to get your attention. It's to draw you in. And having read that headline, you then decide whether or not you want to go any deeper into what that's all about. So that would, if you do, that would be reading the article or whatever it might be. And you can think of sharpness in a photograph in the same way. And what I mean by that is, do you need the whole photograph to be in sharp focus, so the whole of the article in a headline font? Or do you want a certain part of the photograph in focus, nice sharp focus, but the rest of it might be out of focus to some extent? Because what does that do? The area that's in focus draws the eye. So just as the headline will grab your attention, looking at the part of the photograph that is in sharp focus will draw your eye. And then you can start to look around and maybe take in more of what's in that photograph. And I tend to refer to that as providing the context to the subject. So I'm a big believer in visual storytelling, which you may have heard me talk about before. And this is how we achieve it practically. So an example of that, and it's an example I've given before, is if you were to take a portrait of somebody who is involved in the design and building of boats, let's say, in addition to having a nice sharp, or having their face or head and shoulders, whatever you're doing, nice and sharp in the image, maybe over to one side, in the background, you could have either a workshop or their computer screen with some designs on it or whatever, however, if they're doing CAD drawings, whatever it might be. Or you might be in a marina. So that background, although it is not the main focus of the picture, that background provides context. But what it does, because it's a little bit out of focus, the viewer's eye is drawn initially to the person's face, and then they sort of do the little journey around the rest of the photograph. And you will have heard me say this before, most likely, but one of the best definitions I've heard was actually from a guy who photographed trees, which was one of the most inspiring talks actually I've been to photographically, even though trees are something that tend to get in my way when I'm taking photographs. But his comment was that the longer somebody spends looking at a photograph, the better it is. And I thought that was actually a really nice idea, because it implies that as they're looking at the photograph, they're actually finding more and more to take their attention than they initially thought of when they first started looking at the photograph. So that's the first part of this podcast, just to, I guess, bear in mind that what's in focus, or having a photograph where everything is in focus, isn't necessarily a desirable thing. Focus, sharp focus, isn't the objective. It's just a tool along the way, or it's one of the many tools you can choose from in photography to tell the story of whatever it is you photographed. It's a way of engaging people. It's a way of drawing them into the image. So having said all of that, the first thing to look at, probably the most obvious thing, is shutter speed. So that is often where people can get it wrong. It's very simple to change. You might be setting your shutter speed manually. If you are, that's fine, but think about maybe changing the speed you're using. Or you might have a shutter speed priority mode, in which case that might be a thing worth using on your camera, because that means that the camera is basically setting everything else up, primarily your exposure, to support the shutter speed you're operating at. Now, it may be that for whatever it is you're photographing, you want some kind of blurring in there. So it might be movement. So if someone is, say, driving, it might be a car moving along the road. It might be somebody riding a bike. It might be somebody running. So in those situations, it's often quite good to have some motion blur in there, because that puts movement into the photograph. And one of the things that used to irritate me a lot, because I used to do a lot of aircraft photography, and I like to photograph the propeller-driven aircraft. And the worst thing, in my opinion, you can do with one of those photographs is to use a very fast shutter speed, because what it does, it absolutely freezes everything. There is no motion in the propeller blades at all. And you might just as well be photographing a model hanging from a ceiling. Whereas if you reduce your shutter speed, go slower, and just track the subject as you're shooting, so basically pan with your subject, you'll get that blur in the propellers, and just how much blur is completely up to you. So it might be just a bit of blurring on the propeller blade, or it might be just an out of focus disc. But that is, in my opinion, is a much cooler photograph, much more interesting, and is a more engaging photograph. So what are the broad rules for shutter speed? So this is something I've come up with, but so you're welcome to disagree. But to me, if you're using thousandths of a second as your shutter speed, you are freezing the action. So I will often use that for things like a humpback whale breaching, because I want to freeze everything. I want that moment captured, that moment in time where the whale is in the air, there are droplets of water flying everywhere. But I want the viewer to be able to see those individual droplets. That's why I tend to shoot that fast. The other thing about that is that my subject is moving. The whale's clearly moving if it's breaching. I'm moving as well because I'm on a boat, which is most likely rocking. And usually I have to pivot round to where the animal is, because on a few times it has happened that the whale has come up where I've been looking and where I've been pointing my camera. But I'll tell you, most of the time, at least 90%, it's somewhere else. So I've got to turn very, very quickly and be shooting and on that animal within a second, because a breach is over in a couple of seconds. So that would be, that's one example of where you would want to use thousandths of a second. Why don't you want to use thousandths of a second? Well, you may well be pushing what you're capable is, what your camera is capable of. And what I mean is the kind of aperture you've got, because if you're shooting very fast, you need to have the aperture and the ISO set to make sure you get a correct exposure at that speed. So what you don't want to do is have your ISO too high, because things then start to look pretty grainy and horrible. And you may well not have an aperture wide enough in the lens you're using to give you that shutter speed without some compromise in the ISO. So you end up with a grainier looking picture, or a noisier looking picture than you would otherwise have. And a lens, these larger, basically bigger diameter lenses, which give you a much bigger physical aperture, are known as fast lenses, because they do support these faster shutter speeds. But if you're going to be shooting at thousandths of a second, for most of us, and I include myself because I use zoom lenses, zoom telephoto, zoom wide angle for most of my stuff, the action stuff is zoom telephoto, the lens is relatively slow. So I get my best results on bright days because there's more light available and therefore things generally work better. However, if you're trying to do it, shoot really fast on an overcast day, you know, good luck with that, because that can get tricky if you don't have special lenses. But that's the first thing to think about, shutter speed. So that's thousandths of a second to freeze things. If you want some sort of a motion blur, you're then looking at hundreds of a second. So my go-to speed when I was photographing the aeroplanes I was talking about would be 1/125th of a second, so 1/125. And that would allow me to pan with my subject and still get movement. And often not only would it be the propeller blade that had some movement in it, but I've shot some aircraft doing high speed passes over the runway. So I've got things in the background like hedges or houses or whatever, but they're out of focus and blurred. And that's because I want to draw people's eye to the aircraft, which hopefully is pin sharp. I've got my, if I've managed to match it with my panning speed, but everything else, everything that's moving is blurring, everything other than the aircraft. And you can practice this with cars as well. You don't need things to be going really fast to do that. In fact, that can be harder with things that move very fast. So my tip for photographing motorsports, I'm into Formula One also Le Mans event in Australia, is to park yourself at the exit of the pit lane, because the cars are going relatively slowly there. I mean, they're still going pretty fast, but relatively it's a slower speed, and you've got lots of things around that if they're blurred slightly, they add that movement in addition to the wheels on the vehicle itself. Okay, and then if you want to go slower than that, once you start getting to tenths of a second and then into full seconds, that's where you begin to get this blurring. So if you want that kind of ethereal look on water, a good thing to do is to shoot at a tenth of a second or a second, that sort of shutter speed. So obviously if you're moving, if you can't handhold at those speeds, so you then need something else to help you get there. Now, the rule for handholding, this is for full frame cameras and film cameras, but this is the, it's perfectly valid, so you can use this, is the slowest shutter speed you can safely handhold, or most of us, is the reciprocal of the focal length of the lens. What on earth is he talking about? Well, basically, all I mean is that if you've got a 100mm lens, and you want to do a handheld shot with that lens, the slowest shutter speed you should be thinking of using is 1 over 100, so 1 100th of a second, or faster, but you don't want to go any slower than 1 100th. Once you do that, it starts to become tricky, and unless you're incredibly steady, it's almost impossible to shoot at those lower shutter speeds and not get some sort of blurring, even if it's very small. If you blow the image up, you'll suddenly notice that you've got some blurring going on. Now, I'm going to talk about that in a little while as well, but that's something to look out for. So that's giving you an idea of the shutter speeds, what you can achieve with them. And yeah, that's the main sort of thing. So that's the basic one, though. Getting your shutter speed correct is probably the simplest way to correct out of focus image, as in out of focus from blurred images, and why you don't end up with sharp photographs. Now, the next thing I want to talk about is the lens itself. So if you are using the right shutter speed, then you may have a problem with the lens you're using, because some lenses, or the quality of image you get, obviously depends on the optical quality of the lens. And it's definitely the case that some are better than others. Now, my usual recommendation to people, if they're buying a lens for their camera, is to buy the original manufacturer's lens. That is, if it's let me say one of the sort of quality camera brands, so let's say Canon or Nikon, any of the more quality brands. And the reason for that is very simply that if a company is manufacturing professional quality bodies, and more importantly lenses, they will tend to have better quality control in place and produce better quality lenses, even at the lower end of the scale when you think of it money-wise. So the cheaper lenses will still be made to a pretty good quality, and that's simply because these brands really need to maintain their quality, because that's part of their image. It's what people buy them for. And if they start producing bad lenses, even if it's down at the cheaper end, that will still tarnish the brand. So they'll be very careful about that. Some of the independent lenses are good as well. Their quality, I think, has improved quite a lot since 20, 30 years ago. But the best thing you can do, really, if you have the opportunity, is to just take your camera body with you, particularly if you're using a digital camera. Pop in the lens that you're thinking of buying and just try shooting some images with it at different focal lengths, different focus, different apertures, and just have a look and see what you get. If you can zoom into the image on the back of your camera, that's the best way to do it if you're in a store. The best way otherwise to look at the image is to pop it up on, at the very smallest, a laptop screen, or if you have a larger display, pop it on there, because then it'll become very obvious whether things are all nice and sharp, or if you have areas within the lens that aren't quite so good. So that's the first thing, look at the lens that you have. Now, the other thing is that you might be using a lens that isn't quite so hot. So what do you do in that situation? Well, lenses and how they focus is not completely even, let's say. So most lenses perform best at the mid-range apertures. So that would be f8 or f11. So if you're not sure how your lens functions, just try shooting exactly the same image, but do it using different apertures and then just seeing what difference you get. Obviously, you need to compensate to get the right exposure. But have a look and see how your lens is performing, and that will tell you how good or bad it is. And depending on what you find, you don't necessarily need to replace it, but at least then you know that if you shoot at f8 or f11, you're going to get a nice sharp result, a nice sharp subject. If you start to go off those apertures and use other apertures, then you're going to get a drop in quality. So it's more about understanding what your gear can deliver than me saying you need to go out and buy new lenses, because that's not what I'm saying at all. But go just check them out and see what you've got. But then the two things to think about with the lens: who made it? Is it a good quality make? In which case, it should be reasonably comfortable. It should be a reasonably good quality lens. And if not, just check the apertures. Obviously, if you've dropped a lens and you might have messed up the alignment of the elements within the lens, because most lenses have more than one element to them, glass elements to them, then I would get it checked out. Take it to a camera repair store if you have one, ideally a good quality professional outfit, and get them to just check it over, because they should be able to repair the lens. And I used to get, in fact, I still do get my kit, my bodies and my lenses serviced regularly, particularly if I've been away somewhere where they've been abused a little bit, which is, you know, maybe the odd knock here and there and a bit of dust getting in, that sort of thing. Okay, so we've covered shutter speed, we've covered talking about the lenses, and obviously we've also spoken about how desirable it is to have everything in focus, which obviously, as I've said, is not necessarily the case. So having spoken about lenses, the third thing I want to mention is your autofocus settings, assuming that you're using autofocus. Now, you may understand how the autofocus system works on your camera. You might not. It's all good. So most systems use a series of autofocus points. And if you want to see where they are, the camera will generally show you. So generally on it, so I'm talking... I'm talking from experience with DSLRs, so there's other things that will happen, obviously. But just go to the menu page for the autofocus, and usually you will see a very nice pattern of little squares in which tend to occupy the middle part of the screen, and then sort of out to some of the edges, but not necessarily the whole screen. And that what you actually see will depend on the make and model of camera that you're using. And the way autofocus works, it will use those autofocus points to decide what to focus on. So any object within those points, anything that's there, it will focus on that object. However, it's not necessarily all of those points. So you can do zone focusing on some cameras where it will just kind of try and work out what it's seeing across all of the points, then come up with a decision on what the focal length is. Or you can go down to a single AF point and just tell the camera to only focus on whatever is sitting inside that little square. And there are areas in between that give you little zones, little blocks of points to use. Now, what I use a single AF point. It's normally the one right in the center of the viewfinder. And the reason for that is that with photographing wildlife, my subject is often in the undergrowth somewhere. So I've got grass or bushes in between me and it. And then behind it, I might have trees and more bushes and other things. And the point is that there are lots of potential things for the camera to focus on once I've got my subject in frame. And it's very easy for it to focus on a blade of grass in the foreground or a twig in the background. And that means my subject will be out of focus. So what I do is just use that single AF point. I get it on the eye of the animal that I'm photographing. And then I kind of lock it there. So I use a thing called back button focus. I'm not going to go into that today because it's not really relevant for this podcast. But I do talk about it in the courses I give. You can find things on the internet as well. And that's simply a way of me having just, it sets the focus once and I can then forget about it. So what will happen, the focus is set on those systems when you're using autofocus. When you push the shutter button halfway down, that's when it sets the focus. And then when you push the button the rest of the way down, that's when obviously the camera takes the photograph. The problem is if you move slightly or you just get something else on that focal point, that autofocus point, you're going to get an out of focus picture. So that's why back button focus just allows me to carefully set my focus once, and then I can just recompose and do whatever I like, and I don't have to worry about losing focus. So kind of hoping that makes sense, but if you're not sure about that, just check your autofocus, and that is definitely my recommendation, to use just the single AF point, and the one in the center of the screen of the viewfinder is the easiest one to work with. Now, the next thing to talk about, so number four, is a tripod or some other form of support. So if you want to take a long exposure, so I've been talking about shutter speeds, but let's say you want to take something, well, slower than you can handhold the camera and lens combination comfortably, then you need to think about either a tripod or finding some other support. So there may be something around where you can just rest the camera and then take photographs. The other thing about that, if you're using a tripod or some sort of support, is you really want to use a cable release or a remote release, because the act of pressing the shutter button can actually introduce a little bit of wobble into the camera lens combination, and that tiny movement will show up as a little bit of motion blur in the image. So if you don't have a remote release with you, what you can do, and you'll need to just make sure that your camera has this, but most of them do, I believe. So look at the self-timer. Most cameras have a self-timer which give you a couple of settings. One of them is 3 seconds, one of them is 10 seconds or something similar to that. Now, the 10-second self-timer is there so that once you press the shutter button, you can run around to the front of the camera and get into the photograph. So it might be with a group or whatever. I used to, when I was riding around Australia on a motorbike on my own, I would set up a tripod, press the button, and then run back in the 10 seconds, jump on the bike and try and look cool and relaxed while I watched the big fly walk right across the center of the lens while the picture was being taken. But other than those sort of things happening, that's what that 10-second delay is there for. The 3-second is simply to get around the issue of not having a remote release available. So if you press the 3-second timer, it means once you press the shutter button, any little vibration that your movement you've introduced in that action will be over by the time the shutter goes. So that's what that one is there for. So there's ways of getting around that shortcoming. But if you're not sure and you are able to position the camera where you like it, then remember that and think about doing that kind of release. So as I say, that would be where you have a slower shutter speed, or it might be that you want to take the same photograph over a period and do it repeatedly. So again, a tripod is a good way of achieving that. Okay, the fifth thing is flash. So I must admit, flash isn't something I use very often. It's very rare for me to use flash because, again, mostly doing wildlife, that can be very distressing for the animal. And really, as a wildlife photographer, I want to be there as unobtrusively as possible, photographing animals doing their thing. You flash a bright light at them in a dark situation, you're really not going to get their normal nighttime activity. So the thing to remember about the flash, though, is what you'll often get, and it's this, a lot of flash guns now syncs the camera, which is great because then everything works together. But the important thing is not so much what the shutter speed is that you're using on the camera, but what the flash speed is. Because what you want to capture, the only thing that really gets captured is when the subject is lit up by the flash. So that's all you need to worry about. One example of it, or a couple of examples of this, are things I've done when I tried astrophotography. One of the places I went to was a little peninsula to the north of Sydney, and there's a little lighthouse there. So what we would do, I'd set the camera up to do quite a long exposure, maybe 20, 30 seconds, and that was capturing the Milky Way. And what was, in fact, it would have been 20 seconds because I got a feeling the lights on this particular lighthouse came on every 20 seconds. But what I would do was just take a torch and point it at the trees in the foreground and point it at the lighthouse. So I'm basically waving the torch light up and down, so it's covering the whole of the tree, whole of the lighthouse, and it's rather like painting with light. And because the camera shutter is open, as I'm brightening up those areas, that's what's getting recorded on the sensor there. So when the shutter closed again, I've got a nice Milky Way shot because the stars have been exposed long enough to see them. But also I've got my foreground, my tree and my lighthouse are quite brightly lit as well because I've been doing this light painting. So that's how that works. So when you're using flash, obviously you need the shutter open for the same as or longer than the flash is going off for. But beyond that, the most important thing to think about is the duration of the flash. Another thing where you can use that is this light painting where you are set up on a tripod, you're doing a long exposure of a subject and somebody is moving lights around behind them. And if you've never tried light painting, it's a fun thing to do. People create these little rigs of lights and they move them around and it's like a dance, and you get these amazing light patterns around your subject. So that's flash. So and I guess using light as well, but that's another way of getting sharp pictures by just using the flash gun. And finally, I just want to talk about post-processing. Now, the first thing before I do that is to just remind you that the best way to shoot is in RAW. So I shoot all of my photographs in RAW. Some post-processing packages will have a sharpening tool. Some of them are better than others, that's for sure. The thing I use, so if I'm producing an image that is going to be printed professionally to be sold, so I use a printer that has facilities in London and Dusseldorf, and they do museum quality, very high quality prints. So the process I go through, one of the steps is to use software from a company called Topaz Labs, and they have a package called Sharpen AI, and that package will sharpen up images that have got some slight blurring, and it does work. It's quite a good package, which is why I continue. I've been using it for 3 years now, and I've been pretty happy with it. So things like that are available. So if you've got a photograph you really like, but it's just got a bit of motion blur in it, and you know it's just enough to be irritating, you could try Topaz Labs. I forget how much they cost, so it would be something you'd need to check. And in fact, I did a one-off buy, I believe, for the package. But everything's going to subscription models these days, so who knows? But that's another thing to think about, that if all else fails, you do have options in post-processing. So that basically is the podcast. So if you are having problems getting sharp pictures, just bear in mind what I've said. Think first of all about which bits of the picture you want to be sharp. And then just to remind you, we looked at shutter speed. We looked at, the lens and using the correct lens, a good quality, and also looking at how that lens performs over different apertures. We then looked at the autofocus settings, so making sure that that's all working for you. And then things like tripod and using flash to physically get the image acquired if you can't do it within the camera itself. And then finally post-processing. So I hope you found that useful, and I'll speak to you on the next podcast. Bye for now. Just before I go, I want to let you know that there's a couple of ways you can support me if you feel so inclined. With the podcast, Buzzsprout, which is the platform I use for all of my podcasts, they have a subscription model. So if you feel that you would like to subscribe a few dollars, a few euros, whatever, to the podcast, that'd be much appreciated. The other option is my Patreon membership. So if you'd like to become a patron, and that starts at the price of a cup of coffee every month, you'll get access to exclusive material, behind-the-scenes material, photography tips, all this kind of stuff, depending on which tier you're at. So there is information available through my website and also on the written text to go with this podcast. So if you choose either one, thank you so much in advance. And whether or not you do, I hope you continue to enjoy the podcast and let other people know about them. Thank you very much. Bye for now.